you with the what I call the Hamiltonian hegemony, or the final victory of the Hamiltonians, at least in the 19th century. They've kept racking up victories ever since then. And I had occasion to read for one of my university courses this week an essay by Ralph Rako entitled "The Rise and Fall of Classical Liberalism." It was in originally published by the Future of Freedom Foundation. It's fff.org is their website. And it was reprinted on Mises.org, I think, and LouRockwell.com. It was originally in the early 90s, I think, it was published. And it's a broad summary of classical liberalism beginning in the Middle Ages up to the 1990s. Only Ralph Rako could do such a thing. But anyway, when he gets to the period of history about the early America, and after starting his essay talking about the Middle Ages, he noted in there that the big threats to liberty were, or the big, maybe the exceptions, I don't know what you would call it, exceptions to liberty were, of course, slavery, the existence of slavery, and Hamiltonianism. And so those are the two things. That there were Jefferson and quite a few other of the American founders who were very familiar with the classical liberal literature and the practice of governments around the world that did promote, more or less, laissez-faire economics and individual freedom much more than other governments. But there always was this threat of Hamiltonians, and we did not get rid of slavery until 1866. And that's Ralph Rako. So, and I recommend that essay to everyone. It's a tremendous essay. And I believe there's also a video of it on Mises.org. If you go to the media section on Mises.org. And so, moving right along, I thought I'd start talking about how what happened after the Civil War really laid the template for the military-industrial congressional complex, as it's called. And really, if you look at how the U.S. government prosecuted the 25-year-long war, I call it a war of genocide, which it really was, against the Plains Indians, you see a lot of similarities to what happened eventually to with the invasion of the Spanish Empire, the Spanish-American War, and the second invasion of the Philippines. After that, an American entry into World War One, and what happened there, and even up to the present day. And if any of you have ever had the occasion to read a book called War is a Racket by General Smedley Butler, who is reported to be the most highly decorated United States Marine in history. He wrote this little book that's online, War is a Racket. After being in the Marines and being highly decorated for decades, he came to the conclusion that he was pretty much out there operating the killing machine for the benefit of, and he has a long list of all these corporations that were in bed with the government. And that is a part of Hamilton's legacy, in my opinion. If anything defines Hamiltonianism, it's the cozy relationship between business and government. That's what the Hamiltonians were always about in one form or another. And that certainly is the relationship when you have government working hand in hand to indirectly subsidize businesses through military intervention in foreign countries. But first, I think I thought I would refresh your memory to get started on Abe Lincoln's career as a railroad industry lawyer and lobbyist, even before we used the words like lobbyist. And I'll begin by quoting Senator John Sherman, who was the powerful chairman of the United States Senate Finance Committee during the Lincoln administration. And he gave a speech explaining why the Republican Party elected Lincoln as their candidate for president. And he said this, and I'm quoting, "Those who elected Mr. Lincoln expected him to secure to free labor its right to the territories of the United States, to protect by wise revenue laws the labor of our people, to secure the public lands to actual settlers, to develop the internal resources of the country by opening new means of communications between the Atlantic and Pacific, Now, if you study the actual history of what happened, what Lincoln did, and what the Republicans did, it helps you interpret these words, these sort of slippery words by a slippery politician, Senator John Sherman of Ohio. And so he says, those who elected Mr. Lincoln wanted to secure to free labor its just right to the territories. That means keeping all the black people out. That means keeping slaves out. And the Republican Party did oppose the extension of slavery in 1860, but not Southern slavery. It defended to the hilt Southern slavery. It even passed through the Senate a constitutional amendment that would have prohibited the government from ever interfering in Southern slavery, and also keeping free blacks out. Most of the northern states, like Illinois, had amended their constitutions to either make it illegal for free black people to reside there, or they had such onerous Jim Crow laws that the free black people who did live there had no citizenship rights in reality and could barely make a living. They had vagrancy laws where if you were accused of being a vagrant, there would be a $1,000 fine to get out of prison. And so they did everything they could to keep free blacks out of there. And so when John Sherman said Lincoln was their man because they wanted him to secure to free labor its just right to the territories of the United States, he meant free white labor. The second thing he says, to protect by wise revenue laws the labor of our people. That means high protectionist tariffs that would plunder our people for the benefit of corporations who would be protected from competition by that. As John C. Calhoun once said in a speech on the issue of protectionism, he asked the question, protection from what? Well, protection from low prices, that's what. And so that's the second thing. The third reason why Lincoln was elected by the Republicans, said one of the leaders of the Republicans, John Sherman, to secure the public lands to settlers. Well, what actually happened was, according to the historian Leonard Curry, in his book Blueprint for Modern America, which is an excellent book, sort of a classic on the domestic legislation of the Civil War era, he pointed out that only about 19% of all the land under the Homestead Act went to actual farmers. The other 81% went to corporate interests of one form or another. And so that was the third reason why Lincoln was their man. And fourth and finally, to develop the internal resources of the country by opening new means of communication, that meant using taxpayer dollars to subsidize railroad corporations. So those are the four reasons that one of the senior leaders of the Republican Party gave explaining to the public, to the world, why the Republicans elected Abraham Lincoln, why he was their man, he of all people. And so, and I recommended the book, if anybody's interested in this, Lincoln and Railroads by John W. Starr. Really has a lot of detail, well-documented detail about Lincoln's career as a railroad lawyer and lobbyist. And he traveled throughout the Midwest in a private railroad car with a free pass and was accompanied by an entourage of Illinois Central executives. He wore extraordinarily expensive suits and was admired by all the younger men of the era. So he was a wealthy elitist, a wealthy corporate elitist. The image of Abe Lincoln, the log splitter, is just campaign baloney. He was very, very well connected. As I said in the last class, he represented the Illinois Central, the Chicago and Alton, the Ohio and Mississippi Railroads, the Rock Island Railroads, the Chicago and Mississippi Railroads, and he engaged in real estate speculation. I talked about that last week. And when he was president, he bought land before he was president in Council Bluffs, Iowa, a large tract of land. And then when he was president and they passed the Pacific Railway Act, he picked that area, Council Bluffs, Iowa, as the eastern starting point for the building of the Transcontinental. And when he signed the Pacific Railway Act in 1862, he made many, many Republican Party hacks very, very wealthy. Thaddeus Stevens received a block of stock in the Union Pacific Railroad, the government-subsidized and created railroad, in exchange for his vote for subsidy. Oakes Ames, who was a member of Congress from Massachusetts, supported the railroad in return for a promise to use American-made shovels to dig the railway beds. Oakes Ames was a businessman, and his business was the manufacturing of shovels. General Sherman himself was sold land at below market prices as part of this. And so a long list of families became wealthy for generations because of this. And Hear That Lonesome Whistle Blow, I read this quote last week by Dee Brown. He mentioned some of these families. He says it assured the fortunes of a dynasty of American families. And so this was a very big deal. This was the ultimate success of the Hamiltonian idea that we've been talking about for a couple of weeks. Finally, the Southern Democrats left the Congress and they gave up any claim to bringing slaves into new territories, which was a big issue of contention in politics. And on that score, by the way, you have to understand that the issue of the extension of slavery into the territories wasn't just about slavery per se. It was primarily about the weight of votes between the Democrat and Republican parties, because there was a 3/5 clause of the Constitution that existed at the time that said, for purposes of determining how many members of Congress each state would get, every 5 slaves would count as 3 people in the census. And so if slaves were brought into the new territories, it would increase the census population of the territories that were under the control of Democrats, Democratic Party. And so the whole reason, the main reason for this opposition to the extension of slavery that the Republicans gave was not only that they wanted to keep the new territories white, but also it would skew the representation in favor of the Democratic Party. And if that happened, they could not adopt the Hamiltonian American system. And in my book, Lincoln Unmasked, I quote politician after politician from New England primarily as saying that it would be an abomination to allow the extension of slavery into the territories. Why? Not because there would be slaves there, because we could never have our protectionist tariff then if we did that. And it came right out and said it. So if you actually read real history, you read these things, you read the own words, the primary sources of these politicians, they'll tell you they told us this. And so if you look at what happened right after the war, it really is quite remarkable that it's almost as soon as the war ended. In fact, while the war was going on, Grenville Dodge, who was a friend of Lincoln's and was made a general by Lincoln, was given a position as general, even though he didn't have much or any military experience. He was made a general. His main job was to organize a small army that would kill Indians and get them out of the way and commence the building of the Transcontinental Railroads. And so he did that during the war. This sort of thing went on during the war. And then after the war, Grenville Dodge was the chief engineer of the government-subsidized Transcontinental Railroads. And he recommended after the war that the Indians be made into slaves and be forced to dig railroad beds. The U.S. government decided to do something worse than that, worse than making the Indians slaves. They decided to try to kill as many of the Indians as possible. And if you're a slave, at least you can always hope to escape and live a long life as a free man if you escape. But when you're dead, you're dead. And so the objective was to kill as many of the Indians as possible, women and children included, and then put the others in concentration camps and have them live as paupers somewhere. And that, of course, is exactly what happened. And the American Indians are still living on reservations in some parts of the United States today. They're called reservations. They don't call them concentration camps, but they're called reservations. And so literally 3 months after Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox in April of 1865, General Sherman himself was put in charge of the military district of the Missouri. You know, the whole United States was divided up into military districts, central planning style, after the Civil War. and this was all the land west of the Mississippi. And his main job was to kill the Indians, to get rid of the Indians. And why? To make way for the railroads. And so this 25-year-long war of genocide against the Indians was essentially a form of a veiled subsidy to the railroad corporations, because it used tax dollars to pave the way for them. Whereas I mentioned before the class on the chat that a man named James J. Hill did build a privately funded transcontinental railroad, the Great Northern. And you can read about it in some of my books, my book, How Capitalism Saved America. I have an essay on it. I think there's an excerpt on Mises.org. I think it's called The Myth of the Robber Barons. I'm not sure the actual title. I'll look up the title that Mises.org gave it a couple years ago. The Truth About the Robber Barons. There's a section in there about James J. Hill, if you want to read about him, you know, without reading an entire book. And so here's what Sherman himself, in his own memoirs, he said this. He says, as soon as the war ended, quote, my thoughts and feelings at once reverted to the construction of the Great Pacific Railway. I put myself in communication with the parties engaged in the work, visiting them in person, and assured them that I would afford them all possible assistance and encouragement. And he's saying this as he had already been commissioned as the commanding general of the army. They would be doing this. So the assistance was not railroad building assistance. It was Indian filling assistance. And he also said this, quote, we are not going to let a few thieving, ragged Indians check and stop the progress of the railroads. Okay. And so, and Murray Rothbard wrote about this in my article. I quoted him as saying about Grenville Dodge. He said he helped swing the Iowa delegation when Lincoln was seeking the Republican nomination, the Iowa delegation to Lincoln, and in return, early in the Civil War, Lincoln appointed Dodge to Army General. Dodge's task was to clear the Indians from the designated path for the country's first heavily subsidized, federally chartered transcontinental railroad, the Union Pacific. In this way, conscripted, quote, conscripted Union troops and hapless taxpayers were coerced into socializing the cost of constructing and operating the Union Pacific. And this is what happened, this is what the Indian Wars were all about. And so all of the famous generals of the American Civil War on the Union side, Grant, Sherman, Sheridan, Hancock, and quite a few others, became Indian killers after the war. This included not only Sherman, Grant, and so forth, but John Pope, O.O. Howard, Nelson Miles, Alfred Terry, Edward Canby, George Armstrong Custer, Benjamin Garrison, and so really all the Union Army high command from the Civil War just stepped right in to the campaign of genocide against the Indians. And this really did lay the template for what the U.S. military has done in a lot of other wars since then, especially in the imperialistic ventures in the Spanish-American War and other, and today and in Iraq and Afghanistan. You can see the parallels if you really pay attention to what went on here. And so in some of the quotes, if you read my article that I put on the reading list for tonight, I quoted all the main historians of Sherman and the Indian Wars that you can find in the modern era. And here's what one says. Sherman viewed the Indians as he viewed recalcitrant Southerners during the war and the newly freed people after the war, resistors to the legitimate forces of an ordered society. During the Civil War, Sherman and Sheridan had practiced a total war of destruction of property. Now the Army, in its Indian warfare, often wiped out entire villages. That's the historian John Marzalek that said that. Sherman said this also, quoting Sherman himself, the Indians give a fair illustration of the fate of the Negroes if they are released from the control of the whites, end quote. So Sherman thought that both black people and Indians had to be controlled by the whites, or else they would become, as he called them, savages. uncivilized savages. Sherman and Sheridan, Lieutenant General Sheridan, are known for the saying, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. That was their slogan during this time, the post-Civil War decade, 2.5 decades after the Civil War, that they were associated with, and they probably will always be associated with those words. And a lot of, you know, one of the quotes from my article by Sherman is, all the Indians will have to be killed or maintained as a species of paupers. And that, of course, is exactly what happened. And so not only the method that they used was to sneak up on Indian villages, mostly in the wintertime, and because that's when the families would be together. So if you wanted to kill the women and the children, the wintertime was best, because in the summer months, in the warmer months, the men were off and off hunting for long periods of time, and they couldn't get them all. But in the wintertime, they hunkered down, and so they would sneak up on the villages, and by this time, they had rifled cannon, and of course, revolvers and automatic rifles, and they would sneak up on the villages and wipe them out, wipe everyone out, animals and all, horses, dogs, everything. And there was also a concentrated war on the buffalo, the American buffalo. Most economists have studied the near extinction of the American buffalo on the plains, the American plains, ascribe it to what's called the tragedy of the commons. That is, no one owned the buffalo, therefore anyone could go out and shoot hundreds of buffalo a day if they wanted to, because the buffalo pelts were worth a lot of money at that time. I think in the 1870s, they were selling for something like $3.25 per pelt, which would have been a lot of money in those days when you could have shot 100 or more buffalo in one day. Of course, it'd be a lot of hard work skinning all those buffaloes, I would think, but people did that for year after year after year. But it wasn't just that. It wasn't just the tragedy of the commons. The U.S. military went about massively slaughtering the buffalo, because the Indians used the buffalo for everything. Food, they used use it for clothing, the fur, the pelt of the buffalo. They even used the small bones of the buffalo as fish hooks. The Indians would kill a buffalo and gut it and put their infant babies in it in the wintertime to keep them from freezing to death. So the buffalo was, every bit of the buffalo was used for Indian survival, and therefore it was targeted for extinction by the U.S. government, because the Indians were targeted for extinction by the U.S. government. And I quoted an especially disgusting example of how this took place, and it's an example actually during the Civil War, as a part of the Grenville Dodge-style eradication of the Indians to make way for the transcontinental railroads. And it was a U.S. Army officer named Colonel John Shivington, who, there was an Indian village in southeastern Colorado near Sand Creek, where the government, U.S. government, told the Indians, if you fly our flag, we will know you are our friends. And they had made a sort of a peace treaty with them, and we will leave you alone. So these were among the Indians who simply wanted to live in peace. They didn't want to attack the railroads or anything like that. They simply wanted to live as farmers or nomads and whatever existence they could eke out on the plains, and be left alone, and they would leave the white people alone. Colonel Shivington and his troops, according to an account of it by S.L.A. Marshall, who was the chief historian of the European Theater of War in World War II, so this is quite the prominent historian, he wrote this: his troops, quote, began a full day given over to bloodlust, orgiastic mutilation, rapine, and destruction, with Shivington looking on and approving. So they attacked the village and they killed everyone, women included. He said, Shivington and his raiders demonstrated afterwards around Denver, waving their trophies, more than 100 drying scalps. And so D. Brown also wrote about the Sand Creek Massacre in his book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, where he said this: when the troops came up to the squaws, the women, they ran out and showed their persons to let the soldiers know they were squaws and begged for mercy. But the soldiers shot them all. There seemed to be indiscriminate slaughter of men, women, and children. The squaws offered no resistance. Every one of them was scalped by Chivington and his troops. And so, and Custer, of course, is the most famous Indian fighter, so-called Custer. And his orders that were given to him by General Sheridan, his superior, were, quote, to kill or hang all the warriors. And but to Custer, there was a problem. This meant, to Custer, I'm quoting him, quoting D. Brown, it meant separating them from the old men, women, and children. This work was too slow and dangerous for the cavalrymen, and they found it much more efficient and safe to just kill indiscriminately. So in one raid for these riding bodies, they killed 103 Cheyenne Indians, but only 11 of them were warriors. So they would just kill everybody because it was too dangerous to decide who's an old man who can't fight, who's a woman, who's a young boy, who's a young girl. So they killed everybody. Okay, and overall, if you do a little research and look into how many of the Plains Indians were killed, the high number is 45,000 to 50,000, and this includes, of course, many women and children over a 25-year period. And the rest were put into concentration camps called reservations at the same time. And so, part of what went on here is, of course, the government had to demonize the Indians. It called them wild beasts in order to quote, justify the slaughter of them. And, of course, Southerners were dehumanized and demonized during the Civil War and still are to this day to some extent by the government and its apparatchiks of various sorts. And the exact sort of dehumanization was done by the U.S. government when it decided to conquer the Philippines and have the Philippines as part of the American Empire, where President Teddy Roosevelt justified the slaughter of several hundred thousand Filipinos when the Filipinos finally got rid of the Spanish Empire, and then the Americans came in and told them, well, now you're going to be part of the American Empire. You're not going to have independence. They didn't like that, so they revolted, and there was a short war between the Filipino resistance and the U.S. Army. And Teddy Roosevelt referred to the Filipinos, the people in the Philippines, as, quote, savages, half-breeds, a wild and ignorant people. And so this began with the Civil War. The Southerners were demonized and dehumanized. And then it went to the Indians. They were dehumanized also. And then to the Filipinos after that. And so if you fast forward to this day, whatever the enemy is, or the perceived enemy, the same sort of thing happens with stories of this sort. You know, one of the most ridiculous that I can remember is to justify the American intervention in the first Persian Gulf War in the early 90s. The story was put out there by the CIA that the Iraqi army was going into hospitals in Kuwait and pulling the plugs on the incubators where the premature babies were. You know, what could be more cruel and disgusting than murder, not only murdering babies, but premature babies? And so, and they had some woman who came out and said, claimed to have knowledge of this, that worked for the government. And of course, that turned out to be a totally ridiculous lie. And the government was forced to admit that it was a lie. And so this sort of thing of making up stories to dehumanize and demean a perceived enemy, enemy of what? An enemy of imperialism, essentially, started during this era. This was during the period of Hamiltonian hegemony. And that's not the only thing that was really notable during this period. So this business of making war and mass killing for the benefit of corporations was really a hallmark of Hamiltonian hegemony, in my view, and as was corruption, as was massive corruption. And many or most of you or all of you have probably been reading for years about the corruption involved in the American wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. But during this period, when the government started massively subsidizing railroads, it was mass inefficiency for one thing, because there were per mile subsidies, and so since they're spending the government's money, they're not spending their own money. They built very sloppy railroads. They built circuitous routes. Politicians from every state, even the territories that were not yet states, said, if you want our support, you have to build a railroad line to this little town and that little town. And all these railroad lines were uneconomical. There weren't enough people in this little town or that little town to make them profitable. But if they wanted to vote for the subsidies, they had to build the railroad line out to that town, which they did. So if you look at a map of the transcontinental railroads that the government subsidized, you know, from the Midwest to California, it looks kind of like a bowl of spaghetti because of all the vote buying that was required. Whereas James J. Hill, who built the privately funded transcontinental railroad, his main concern was minimizing costs, because when you minimize costs, you maximize profit. And of course, it wasn't just minimizing costs at any expense, you know, by any means. You had to also maintain quality, because they did have competition. So it wasn't minimizing costs by providing a shady railroad, a poorly built railroad. Quite the opposite. He actually used better quality building materials than the government subsidized railroads did. But he made a point to find the shortest, most economical route to the West Coast that he could get. And he did a lot of other things, such as subsidizing the farmers along the way with grain, with cattle, with livestock, with agricultural expertise, and so forth, because he understood that if these small towns along his railroad route did not prosper, neither would his railroads. And so the government-subsidized railroads were exactly the opposite, mostly inefficient, because they were government-subsidized. And that, of course, is what the Jeffersonians always understood and warned about forever, you know, for since the beginning of the American Republic. Now, as far as the corruption, it was totally predictable that there would be massive corruption. And so you could do the research yourself. You look up the web, look up the Crédit Mobilier scandal, C-R-E-I-D-I-T, credit. And the second word is spelled M-O-B-I-L-I-E-R, scandal. And as an example of one of the things that went on, these men, some of the big shots in the Republican Party, formed their own company or companies called the Crédit Mobilier Company. And they built, it was used to procure materials and build the railroads, railroad lines. And the management often charged the government twice or more of what it actually cost to build the railroad. So they made huge pockets of cash, and they bought off members of Congress and other influential politicians, including executive branch politicians, to go along with this and to support this and to keep the subsidies flowing by giving them stock in the company. And among the people who got stock in the company and who finally got caught, and this was a big scandal I'll read some of them. Vice President Schuyler Colfax, President Grant's vice president. Senators Henry Wilson of Massachusetts, James Patterson of New Hampshire, and John Logan of Illinois. Speaker of the House, James Blaine, Congressman W.D. Kelly of Pennsylvania, James Garfield of Ohio, James Brooks of New York, John Bingham of Ohio, Henry Dawes of Massachusetts, and Glennie Schofield of Pennsylvania. So many of the leading lights of New England politics and Northern politics were caught up in the Crédit Mobilier scandal, whereby they would be given shares of stock that were trading maybe at $5 a share, but the insiders knew that they were about to pay themselves maybe 20 times what it cost to buy some railroad ties for the railroads, and so that this company was about to make a gigantic profit. And as soon as the gigantic profit was announced, the stock would go maybe from $5 to $50 a share. And so many of these men became very, very wealthy through this vote buying scheme. And It all came public, if you read the history books, when several members of the scheme were having a big argument over something, and one of them got so ticked off that he blew the whistle, called in a journalist, and told them the whole story. you know, so disgusted with what was going on. And so it became public, and it became, you know, the biggest scandal in American history up to that point in terms of theft of government money. And that, of course, is exactly what the Jeffersonians always warned against, because they understood European political history very well, and the history of the world very well. And so that's what happened. And you see the establishment of all these precedents that we see today. I mentioned last week a book by Gabriel Colco, The Triumph of Conservatism. And here's one quote about what happened in the late 19th, early 20th century. Colco called it, quote, a reincarnation of the Hamiltonian unity of politics and economics. And he called it also, quote, the new Hamiltonianism. And it certainly was. And so the big difference between this and what I talked about last week, though, was the military was recruited. And once the Civil War was over, the military was recruited to make the way for the Grand, Transcontinental Railroads, so that these government-created railroad corporations could profit. And then something similar things happened later in American history with the conquest of Hawaii. Hawaii was essentially taken over by the U.S. military and forced to adopt a new constitution and become a part of the United States. And one of the politicians involved in this, his last name was Dole, D-O-L-E, as in Dole Pineapple Company. And so part of the motivation for the takeover of Hawaii, and you know, decades after the Civil War, was to take over the pineapple plantations in Hawaii, which to this day, are, of course, huge money makers. And similar things happened in Cuba and Puerto Rico and the Philippines and all throughout American history. You might wonder why the American military today, last week, we read in the news, is now involved in Mali for some reason, where there are natural gas resources. It's often about the resources that some American corporation wants to get their hands on, and they use the military to help them out to do it. War is a racket, as Smedley Butler said. And so that's the story of the post-Civil War era and with this ultimate triumph of Hamiltonianism linked with militarism. And so I think that's all I'm going to have to say for tonight. And the last class will be on the big events. The cementing in place of the Hamiltonian system in the year 1913, when they got the Fed, the income tax, and the 17th Amendment all in one year. And I want to explore the economic consequences of all of that next week. But for now, we'll do what we usually do, and I'll see if there are some questions here. And I'll be glad to do my best to try to answer whatever questions anybody has. Answered some on the website for the class before the class. Okay, James Blackston asked, why are Jim Crow laws always referred to the Southern? Well, that's because American history was rewritten by New Englanders after the Civil War. That really is the answer, because the origin of the so-called Jim Crow laws not only was the origin in the northern states like Illinois, but the Jim Crow laws were put in place by the U.S. government and the U.S. military during Reconstruction. The U.S. government controlled the South for 10 years after the war was over. It was a military dictatorship over the southern states. You know, the governors and the mayors were all put in place by the Republican Party. In the South, they were puppet governments, and the Jim Crow laws, which started in the North, were put into place by Northern politicians, and then, of course, they kept them after the Civil War. And so, if you want to read books about this, let me get you some exact citations. Steve Van Woodward, the letter C, initial C, Van, V-A-N-N, Woodward, W-O-O-D-W-A-R-D, The Strange Career of Jim Crow. That's a history of Jim Crow laws. it shows how the laws originated in the northern states. Another one is North of Slavery, the Negro in the Free States, 1790 to 1860. The author of that book is Leon Litwack, L-I-T-W-A-C-K. So if you want to read about the history of these things, those are two of the most widely cited books that you can get on that subject. And so they're always referred to as Southern because it's just one of the 10,000 ways that the New Englanders thought of it as continuing to demonize Southerners to justify what they did, waging war over money that involved killing hundreds of thousands of their fellow citizens. You have to think of all kinds of excuses. That's why Lincoln wrapped himself around slavery eventually. What else could he do? Let's see, Russ is asking about Malcolm's question about how do the land clubs use ostracism. Read the article by Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill on an American experiment in anarcho-capitalism, about the wild, wild west. It gives a lot of detail about that. Well, ostracism means you don't do business with that person. You don't socialize with that person. You ignore that person. You don't do anything for him. You shun him. That's social ostracism. You don't let him join your church. There are all kinds of ways in which people have used in the past social ostracism. It wasn't just the wagon trains. Another example of this phenomenon is there's a book called Order Without Law. And it's a case study of people in the American West in California, in the farming country in Northern California. That have explicit and implicit contracts regarding what happens if, say, my cattle get loose and trample on your corn in the field, your cornfield that's door. And if you don't cooperate with the system to minimize that kind of damage and expense, social ostracism is used. You're not a part of the community. People won't do business with you. They won't offer you business contacts. They won't do it. They won't lend you money if they're a bank, and so forth. So this is not unique to the mining camps of the American frontier. This is something that was and is pervasive in a lot of communities. People just don't know about it unless you study these things and read these books, for example. Too many economists are prone to just say that whenever you have problems like this, government needs to come in and police these people. But if such people are a problem, human beings are problem solvers. And so we often do devise ways of solving these problems without government. Well, I also answered this question about crime rates. There were no statistics on crime rates in the American frontier. The government didn't even exist back then. That's who mostly collects crime statistics. There's anecdotal evidence, and Anderson and Hill write about it. There was not even an FBI back then. That's where modern researchers get their crime statistics, for the most part. Let's see, is there a book on Grenville, it's Dodge, D-O-D-G-E, like the Dodge car. I cite D. Brown in his book, Hear That Lonesome Whistle Blow, discusses Grenville Dodge's proposal to make slaves out of the Indians. So if you want to look it up, I would get a hold of D. Brown's book and look up that section and find the reference. I might even be able to get you a page number. Let me see if I can. I might be able to page them. Let me see. No, no, I don't think so. But you can look it up if you want to. That's the reference that I used in one of my books, D. Brown's book. D. Brown was the historian of the American West. Did the Indians ever attack the settlers unjustifiably? Well, yes, of course, because the American government had broken treaty after treaty after treaty, and it brutalized them. So they did what human beings often do, there was blowback. So that was an early version of blowback. If you read my article, you know that the relationship between the Americans and the Indians was primarily, for a long, long time, trade rather than raid. It was trade. There were hundreds of millions of dollars were spent buying land from the Indians rather than killing them and taking their land. There was a lot of trade. There was a lot of intermarriage. The chief of the Cherokee Nation in Tennessee was a white man named John Ross. And so the real world was not like the John Wayne movies, where you had these soldiers in blue uniforms running around on horses, shooting for 2.5 hours straight, killing Indian after Indian after Indian. It wasn't always like that. But if you read my article, you'll know that there was a sea change in this type of behavior. There was always some degree of violence, but after the Civil War, the U.S. government decided to really step up the violence against the Indians, and Congress even passed a law saying no more treaties, no more voluntary agreements with the Indians. We're done with that, and so it was war, against extermination. Afterwards, so the Indian attacks, I would call an early version of blowback for the most part. I'm looking for some more questions, if there are any. Let's see, Jim is asking reading suggestions about some reservation land was given to individual Indians. I don't know about that, but I do know that Terry Anderson has written a book about a U.S. government policy toward the Indians. So if I were to try to look that up, and from a reliable researcher, I would look up Terry Anderson and find his book on the Indians and government policy toward the Indians. I can't remember the title of the book. But if you look up Terry Anderson on the web, you'll probably find him. Terry Anderson is for 30 years has been associated with the free market environmentalism movement in Montana. Yeah, do we have some other questions? Let's see, James Blackston, he says, I understand most Indians fought for the South. That had anything to do with Sherman's desire to kill all the Indians, not just Sherman, but I think I quoted S.L.A. Marshall in my article that's on the reading list for tonight. It's saying that most of the Indians did actually, who got involved in the Civil War, fought on the side of the South, because they knew what the government was already doing, that Grenville Dodge, not Sherman, but Grenville Dodge and others, such as General Pope, had been wiping out Indians during the war to make way in advance for the transcontinental railroads. And so I forget where this quote is, but I do remember citing Marshall as saying that. Let's see. I can't remember exactly where that was. I know Marshall did say that. And so there were I think five or six tribes who fought on the side of the Confederacy during the American Civil War. William Dwyer says the Indians were not made slaves because it was too difficult to find the runaways. Well, I'm not sure what the reasons were given. The government decided to kill them instead of enslave them. Runaways are always difficult. That's why the government subsidized slavery in the southern states with the Fugitive Slave Act, because it compelled northerners to hunt down runaway slaves and return them to their owners at their expense. And so, and there was a federal bounty on the runaway slaves. That's why the famous Underground Railroad ended up in Canada. The slave escaped from say Alabama and popped up in Pennsylvania or New York. He would have a federal bounty on his head, and so still could be returned into slavery. And so they ended up in Canada during that time. I don't know if that's true or not. If that was the reason. Makes sense, though. And one of the ironies of post-Civil War era is that there's been a movie made about the so-called Buffalo Soldiers, who were the ex-slaves. Black slaves who joined the U.S. Army after the Civil War and participated in the Indian Wars. So here's a colored race that had been enslaved, and they were now free, who were participating in the army of the government that had enslaved their people for generations to mass murder another colored race, the enslaved Indians. And it's really kind of sickening that the so-called Buffalo Soldiers are glorified, and they make movies about them, and they write books about them, because what they were doing was truly awful. But that's contemporary American society. I looked up why they were called Buffalo Soldiers, and the Indians gave that name because they thought the hair on the heads of the ex-slaves looked like buffalo hair. And in all my reading about the Indian Wars, that's what I found. Any other questions by any chance? If there's anything on the Q&A here. Question from Eric. Is there a group in Congress that had a different approach to the Indian problem and wanted to pursue a more fair solution? Well, I do quote in my article on the agreements for tonight some high-ranking members of Congress expressing utter disgust over what the crazy Republicans were doing with their war against the Indians for the benefit of railroad corporations. And so, yes, there were members of Congress. You can look up quotes in my article if you want. And although Congress did vote, they did get a majority of Congress to vote to end all treaties with the Indians in 1871. And so the majority voted for that and got it passed. But there were members, there were dissenters who were. And I also mentioned in the book that a lot of members of Congress didn't know what was going on. I mean, this was long before the Internet, of course. And so I quote Sherman himself as telling his subordinates, leave Congress up to me. If word gets out, if some journalist comes out here and finds out what we're doing, leave it up to me, General Sherman, to intimidate the journalists and the members of Congress who think that they might want to look into this. And so those aren't his exact words, but he said something like that. I quote his exact words in my article that's on the reading list tonight. And saying that, so a lot of members of Congress, most, had no idea of how grotesque the behavior of Custer and the rest was. So all for the benefit of corporate welfare. This is, keep in mind, that's the main point from an economic perspective. was that this was a veiled form of corporate welfare. That's why it happened. Okay, let's see, we seem to be running out of steam again tonight. Well, if there are no more questions, we can call it a night, I guess. Well, here's more questions all of a sudden. After Democrats won the Congress back in the late 1870s, did this change corruption at all? No, the cat was out of the bag. The corruption, there's an American conservative journalist some years ago wrote about conservative politicians. And in the 19th century, the Democrats were the conservatives. He wrote about them that when they're out of Congress, they refer to Washington, D.C. as a cesspool. It's disgusting. But when they're there, once they're there, they get elected to Congress, they change their mind, and they start thinking of it as more like a hot tub. And so, and this is probably not just true in our day. I think this is probably true always. And so I suspect that they did little to stop corruption. If Lincoln, direct Custer and Sherman, no, Lincoln was dead when this happened. Lincoln was involved in the killing of Indians because it was his commanders that existed during the Sand Creek Massacre, although he may not have directly known about that. But Lincoln was involved in an Indian revolt in Minnesota during the Civil War, where the government once again reneged on a contract or a treaty with the Indians. It offered to pay them $400,000 for a large tract of land in Minnesota. This was some of the Sioux Indians, and it didn't pay. And the Sioux that were starving, they were not doing very well, their children were dying, and the government, the U.S. government, just gave them a big middle finger and just simply didn't pay. They just took their land and didn't pay for it. And so there was a revolt. There was about a 30-year war, so-called, between these Indians and the U.S. Army. And so Lincoln did send troops out there. And the Army rounded up all the Indians that were there at the end of the hostilities and wanted to hang every one of them. And Lincoln himself thought that this would be very bad publicity if they hung 300 Indians. And so he whittled the number down to, I forget the exact number, it might have been 33 or something like that. So they ended up hanging 33 of these people, whose only crime was they happened to be present when the hostilities ended. They were never accused of anything specifically, but that was it. So Lincoln was somewhat involved in the massacring of Indians and the treatment of Indians in this way. And all of this took place after he was dead. The Great Indian Wars started 3 months after the Civil War ended, and 3 months after Lincoln's death. Who made the decision to kill the Indians? This was General Grant, who was in charge of the Army. And so then when he became president, he had two terms as president, was the bulk of the Indian Wars, and then the Republican Party after Grant. The Indian Wars lasted until 1890. Sherman died in 1890, and that was pretty much the end of the Indian Wars, the year Sherman died. And in his memoirs, by the way, he wrote a letter that he wrote to his son 1 year before he died. And he said one of his biggest regrets in life is that his armies did not kill every last Indian in North America. And so the whole government apparatus, but it was led by Grant for 8 years after the war, after he became president for two terms. And he put his buddy Sherman in charge, and then Sherman put General Philip Sheridan in charge of the West. But Sherman was the commanding general of the Army, and Sheridan was in charge of the West and the Indian Wars for quite a few years. And so Grant, Sherman, and Sheridan are the biggest culprits in the Indian Wars. Any other questions? We're whittled down to the number of attendees is whittling down. Okay, well, maybe we'll call it a night then, guys. Thanks again for participating. I hope you all learned a little bit about economics and history tonight. That's what I try to do with most of these courses I'm teaching here in the Mises Academy. And I really do think that this laid the template for the military-industrial-congressional complex for many years to come. So thanks a lot for participating again, and thanks for all the good questions. If you have more, you can always email me or write questions on the discussion group on the web on Mises Academy. And have a good night.